did you kill Marlene Johnson?
I think you're one of the first people to have actually asked.
From WBUR and ZSP Media, this is Beyond All Repair, a new podcast about an unsolved murder that will leave you questioning everything.
Wow, it just gets more interesting.
Beyond All Repair. Listen and follow on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Reveal is brought to you by Progressive, where customers who save by switching their home and car save nearly $800 on average. Quote at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $793 by new customers surveyed who save with Progressive between June 2021 and May 2022. Potential savings will vary.
From the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX, this is Reveal. I'm Ike Sriskandaraja, filling in for Al Letson. Last August, we brought you a story from a young teacher living in Kabul named Aisha. We're only using her first name for her and her family's safety in Afghanistan. Almost a year ago to the day, Aisha was at home, standing on her balcony, listening to children running around below in the courtyard.
The kids are playing regardless of the threats and the dangers that is coming towards them. They're playing hide and seek, running after each other. Don't you catch me, you didn't catch me, this is not fair.
The U.S. was finalizing its withdrawal from Afghanistan while the Taliban was capturing more and more of the country. Aisha was hunkered down with her family, and she shared recordings with us of what life was like just as the Taliban closed in on Kabul.
So much happened in 24 hours. Every second was a news. Every single second, there was a rumor that would turn to a breaking news. The first thing that I heard was that the banks are getting closed. If anyone has any assets or money, they should take it out. Later on, I discovered that Taliban had started removing female women's pictures from the public. I packed my clothes to nowhere. I have no place to go. And I told my mom, "Mom, if I die, give this to the beggars. If I go somewhere, then I will take them with me." She told me, "Keep quiet, don't say such things." But I packed my clothes. I kept myself busy. And then my brother came in. He picked me up because he told me that Taliban are here from north and south. From two sides, they are coming inside. So he said, "Come, let's go." And I held his hand and I ran with him.
The Taliban would take over the presidential palace with little resistance. And Aisha, like thousands of other Afghans, headed to Hamid Karzai Airport to flee the country. A year ago, we focused on the last days of America's longest war. Today, on Reveal, we're looking at how Afghanistan's future hinges largely on one question. Do you recognize the Taliban? And how every yes, no, or maybe comes with a price. There isn't a single country in the world that recognizes the Taliban as a legitimate government. And neither does Aisha. She left Afghanistan last August and has been living in a hotel in England ever since, waiting to be rehoused by the British government. For work, she's cooking meals for other newly arrived Afghans at the hotel where she lives.
First of all, salam, Aisha. How are you doing?
Alaikum salam, Najib Jan. I'm doing good. Thank you for asking.
Reveal's Najib Amini has stayed in touch with Aisha over the past year. He checked back in with her a few weeks ago.
Where did you just come from?
I came from my work, actually.
How long have you been cooking?
8 months.
8 months. But before, were you always like, was it something that you would do, or is this like a new thing for you?
I would have never thought to become a cook in my life because I was a teacher and I had this life in Afghanistan. And I barely cooked anything in my home also. Today is a different life.
Have you had any favorite dish?
Nothing.
Oh, geez. I'm sorry to hear. How do you like the fish and chips?
I haven't had it yet. I'm cutting carbs.
Is that why?
The food in here is very different, Najib John. The food of Afghanistan was very tasty, very natural. Gathered 100 of strawberries in here and it will taste the amount of one strawberry back in Afghanistan. The only thing that tastes in here is good Wi-Fi.
Yeah, unfortunately you can't taste that.
Nothing more.
I mean, what has your last year been like?
Unpredictable. My life experience is maybe a lesson of what stuff will a woman face to have her freedom as an Afghan woman.
Do you remember packing your bag?
Of course I remember packing my bags, and I still have that bag with me.
What was in the bag?
My computer, my charger, some family photos, 2 pens and my notebook of poems, some memories from my niece and nephews, and a pair of clothes. I packed my memories with me.
What made you want to leave the country and not recognize an Afghanistan under Taliban control?
The history, the past, the way that they took the country was an obvious reflection of how will they be ruling the country. It was not a peaceful matter. There was no negotiation. And there was no recognition for the woman. I felt it that I am not welcomed. I knew that the moment that they step in this country and they take over, we are doomed.
Was there any point over the last several months where you either felt vindicated or like you made the right decision?
I think I made the right decision. It hurts me. It does hurt me that I am not where I'm supposed to be. I am not where I was planning to be. But I feel grateful also to be away and safe and having a bed to sleep, a roof to be under it, and food to eat without any tension of anything that's around me. But of course, the country is in my heart. Afghanistan is always in my heart, and it's my blood. And we can't get rid of our blood.
When you talk to your friends who are still there, and they might be down, they might be talking to you about, oh, this Taliban member did this, what do you say to them to try and lift up their spirits?
Good days will come. We have faced the worst. And this will pass also. It's just a matter of time.
And you believe that?
I believe that.
Are there days where you don't?
I don't want to be among the people who loses hope. And in the history, no brutal government has ever been able to continue. Maybe it would take a couple of years, maybe a century, but it will finish one day. And if I was not able to step back to a peaceful Afghanistan, I'll make sure my daughter does.
Aisha is applying to master's programs in international law. Her goal? To work for the United Nations, helping immigrants and refugees. Last August, she was one of more than 120,000 people who were evacuated during the U.S.-led airlift. But those who didn't have the connections or the luck to catch a flight had to find other ways out. One option many Afghans turned to was something called humanitarian parole, or HP. It gives temporary entry into the U.S. for humanitarian reasons. And many Afghans who feared being targeted by the Taliban applied, thinking they would be eligible. But earlier this year, Najib filed a FOIA and started learning that it was a little more complicated than that.
As I've been looking into the Afghan HP applications, I've talked to a lot of people who have helped others file for it. Lawyers and advocates like Uge Momand. And last year, like a lot of other people in the Afghan diaspora, she was being contacted in every way possible from people trying to leave Afghanistan.
For me, I'm the only lawyer in my family, so it became like everyone I've ever known, everyone I've ever spoken to is sending me a message on Instagram, is finding my number, is emailing me.
The application is a burdensome process that requires a lot of paperwork. Proof of danger, proof of identification, a U.S. sponsor.
For a lot of Afghans, they couldn't have done this process without a lawyer because the forms are so confusing and this process is not done very often.
And this already difficult administrative process is harder because there's no active U.S. embassy in Afghanistan. It closed last August and has remained closed because the U.S. doesn't recognize the Taliban. The HP application requires fingerprints and security checks, things that can only be done at an embassy.
And there's the fee. It was a $575 fee for every single application. So if you have a family of five, that's thousands of dollars right away.
Even so, a lot of Afghans have still applied. More than 66,000 from July 2021 to May this year. That's according to FOIA data from the United States Citizenship and Immigration Services, or USCIS.
There are a lot of people who have applied for humanitarian parole. It's the teachers, it's the former government workers, it's the judges, the lawyers, the city workers, just your regular run-of-the-mill people in your neighborhood who are now under threat because of a Taliban-controlled government.
From start to finish, USCIS says it should take 90 days to process an HP application. The FOIA data shows it's taken more than twice as long for the Afghan HP applications. Twice as long if the application has been decided on at all. The USCIS numbers show that most applications haven't been fully processed, which means a lot of people are still in limbo.
Me and my family are living in a very bad conditions. Our only hope was getting approved in humanitarian parole.
I spoke to one Afghan HP applicant named Niloufar. She used to be a teacher, and she's still living in the country. And her father-in-law worked for the previous government. It's why she applied for HP, why she feels under threat, and why we're only using her first name.
It has been a long time since we applied for HP, but still we do not hear any response from USCIS, even positive or negative. We are still waiting.
What is that waiting like?
We are in our homes. We don't go out. We don't go shopping. We don't go park. We don't go anywhere. We are just stay at home in a very bad situation and really bad economical and also mental situation. We do not know how long we can continue to stay safe.
So why is this all taking so long? If you ask USCIS, the agency is drowning in applications. In a typical year, USCIS receives fewer than 2,000 HP applications from all over the world. In the 10 months of data we looked at, Afghan applications alone were more than 30 times that. And Afghans are still applying.
There's not like a significant percentage of these applications that have been processed. So even then, people, I think, have been holding on to like well, okay, they haven't gotten to our application yet. There's still a chance. There's still a chance. And so, you know, people are still applying for it. And then they see news of the Ukrainian program and they keep applying for it, because if Ukrainians can get those benefits, then why can't we?
Today, I'm announcing a program, Unite for Ukraine, a new program to enable Ukrainians seeking refuge to come directly from Europe to the United States. This new humanitarian parole program will complement the...
2 months after Russia invaded Ukraine and more than 8 months after the fall of Kabul, President Biden announced Uniting for Ukraine, or U for U. It's an HP program specifically for Ukrainians caught in the conflict.
This program will be fast. It will be streamlined.
The U for U process requires only one form. It can be filled out online and doesn't require an in-person interview. Ukrainians don't need to prove that they are in danger, and they need to apply through a U.S. sponsor. Plus, it's free. There's no application fee.
And will ensure the United States honors its commitment to go to the people of Ukraine and need not go through our southern border.
As of early August, USCIS received more than 97,000 U4U applications, and it approved more than 68,000. The agency didn't collect any money in application fees. Compare that to the Afghan HP. The 10 months of data we looked at showed USCIS collected nearly $20 million from Afghan applications. More than 66,000 people applied, and out of thousands of applicants, just 123 were approved. They're hard numbers to stomach for legal advocates like Uge, even though she fully supports the U4U program.
Of course we want that program for Ukrainians. We're so happy to see it. We're so happy that a pathway like that exists. It's the exact same thing we've been asking for Afghans.
We reached out to the Department of Homeland Security, which oversees USCIS, to ask about the discrepancy. The spokesperson we heard back from wouldn't answer our questions about the HP programs. Instead, they pointed to the tens of thousands of Afghans who were evacuated to the U.S. after the fall of Kabul. The spokesperson added, quote, "We are prepared to welcome additional Afghans over the coming weeks and months." What do you think it says about USCIS approach or the Biden administration that this is the handling of Afghans seeking humanitarian parole? Like, what to you, what is it saying?
I think it's really obvious what it's saying. USCIS, the Biden administration, they don't want brown immigrants in the country. To see it so explicitly, it's difficult. It's hard. We don't know what to tell people. We don't know what to tell our clients other than these systems are racist. Our community has been through so much and it's seemingly not stopping, right? As if 20 years of occupation and war wasn't enough.
Najeeb Amini reported that story with data help from Dhruv Mehrotra. They figured out just what a tiny, tiny percentage of Afghan HP applications got approved, especially when compared with the Ukrainian program. If you want to see the numbers we got from the government for yourself, visit revealnews.org. And coming up, we take a trip.
8 stories below where we're standing sits the world's largest stockpile of gold.
And bring our recognition question to an economist.
Frozen funds and sanctions equal to misery, hardship, cruelty, and punishment.
The cost of saying no. That's next on Reveal.
Support for Reveal comes from Odoo. What is Odoo? Well, Odoo is an all-in-one management software with apps for every business need. Odoo has apps for CRM, accounting, sales, HR, inventory, manufacturing, and everything in between, and they're all in one easy-to-use software. And the best part about Odoo? All Odoo apps are integrated, helping you get things done faster and more efficiently. So when you think about business, think Odoo. To learn more, visit odoo.com/reveal. That's odoo.com/reveal.
This podcast is supported by Americans United for Separation of Church and State. Americans United defends your freedom to live as yourself and believe as you choose, so long as you don't harm others. Core freedoms like abortion rights, marriage equality, public education, and even democracy itself rest upon the wall of separation between church and state. A network of anti-democratic groups are attacking these freedoms, seeking to force us all to live by their narrow beliefs. Americans United is fighting back. Freedom without favor and equality without exception. Learn more about AU's work at au.org/MJ.
At Radiolab, we love nothing more than nerding out about science, neuroscience, chemistry.
But we do also like to get into other kinds of stories. Stories about policing or
politics,
country music,
hockey,
sex. Of bugs.
Regardless of whether we're looking at science or not science, we bring a rigorous curiosity to get you the answers.
And hopefully make you see the world anew.
Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know.
Wherever you get your podcasts.
From the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX, this is Review.
This is Ekstri Skandaraja. Guest hosting for Al Letson, and coming to you from downtown Manhattan, the financial district, to meet my colleague Najib Amini. I see Najib. What's up, Najib?
Ike, you made it.
Yeah. I'm here. Met you at this building at NASA and Liberty.
Ike, this isn't any building. This is the Federal Reserve Bank of New York. You're looking at a 14-story building. You see these arches that are covered in iron. I mean, it just looks like a fortress. In fact, 8 stories below where we're standing sits the world's largest stockpile of gold.
This certainly is the Federal Reserve Bank of New York. I can see that on the plaque, but I want you to tell me why we are here right now.
The reason why we're here is because inside this building sits about $7 billion. $7 billion that belongs to the Afghan people. So for the past year, it's been frozen, untouchable, inaccessible, just sitting here in this building.
Okay, but first of all, why is Afghanistan's money in a fortress in New York?
So it's actually not uncommon for foreign governments to place their money in this building. They store their money here because it's safe, it's secure, and you get good returns.
So what's the holdup?
Why is it frozen?
Yeah, why is it frozen?
So it has a lot to do with that question that we asked at the top of the show.
Do you recognize the Taliban as the leaders of Afghanistan?
Right. The assets are frozen because the U.S. doesn't recognize the people in power in Afghanistan. The Biden administration blocked access to the money when the Taliban took control of the country to keep them from using it. Quick context, Ike. Afghanistan's annual GDP is around $20 billion. So not being able to access assets worth $7 billion, it's a big deal.
I think to anybody, let alone a cash-strapped nation, not having $7 billion is a problem. And if I was one of those people living in that country, I'd want to know, when am I going to get my money back?
I want to tell you the story about one Afghan economist who has spent the last year trying to convince the U.S. to unfreeze these assets.
Well, why don't we get off this corner and why don't you tell us about it?
Sounds good.
There are only a handful of people who know the ins and outs of Afghanistan's economy better than Dr. Shah Marabi. By day, he's a professor.
Hello, class. This is macroeconomics, Econ 201.
He teaches economics at Montgomery College in Maryland.
Come to class with positive attitude, relax, and enjoy learning economics, and I look forward to seeing you.
But it's Dr. Marabi's other role, his non-academic one, that's made the last year so busy. He sits on the Supreme Council for the Afghan Central Bank, Afghanistan's version of the Federal Reserve.
My whole purpose is, look, I'm Afghan-American. I have family in Afghanistan. And ordinary Afghans, their security, their financial well-being is of concern to me. It is in my role as a member of the Supreme Council to make sure that we adhere to the main function of the central bank. And that purpose to help ordinary Afghans and to make sure that they are not suffering as a result of economic miscalculation.
His work there for the last 20 years has made him the go-to guy on all things related to the Afghan economy, which even before the Taliban took over, wasn't doing that great.
First, you had COVID. Second, you had drought. Agriculture sector was in total disarray, and it was in an artificial economy run by donors. And obviously, when the new government came, all of it disappeared.
This was the economic landscape. And then came the news about the central bank assets.
The U.S. government has frozen nearly all the foreign currency reserves.
The assets were frozen when the Taliban took control in August.
As it tries to keep the Taliban from accessing government money.
The United States froze the central bank reserves to keep the Taliban from using them. Dr. Marabi argues that the central bank is set up to operate independently of whoever runs the country. Independent or not, the central bank can't function without its assets, which Dr. Marabi says all but guarantees an economic collapse. So he starts ringing the alarm bells and talks to anyone who will listen.
We're fortunate to be joined now by Professor Shah Mehrabi.
He's Shah Mehrabi.
Interview with Dr. Shah Mehrabi.
You're on mute, Dr. Mehrabi. You should unmute yourself.
Good morning. I'm sorry.
He goes on a media tour to warn the world about what's coming.
We will have food shortages,
double-digit inflation, a decline in imports prices will increase immense poverty, hunger and starvation,
and famine.
And he proposes a solution. Have the U.S. slowly release the funds.
Allow access to 150 million per month.
Monitor all the transactions.
These funds are used exclusively for stabilizing the economy.
And if the U.S. sees any hint of improper use,
they can cut off the funds at any moment.
Dr. Mehrabi says this way, Afghanistan could start to get its economy back on track. And the U.S. could feel secure that the Taliban wasn't using the money for, quote, illicit purposes. By the end of 2021, all the media attention gets Dr. Mehrabi a bunch of meetings with members of Congress. Those lawmakers turn around and write a letter to President Biden, urging his administration to unfreeze the Afghan central bank assets. But at the same time Dr. Mehrabi was making all this progress, there's another group of people working to release the funds, just not to the Afghan people. Years after the 9/11 attacks, some surviving family members filed lawsuits against the Taliban. Not surprisingly, the Taliban never showed up in court, and the families won their cases. But they had a slim chance of ever collecting any money. That is until last August, when the Taliban rose to power.
The plaintiff's argument basically was that when the Taliban took control of the state of Afghanistan, that they essentially became the owners of the government of Afghanistan's various assets.
Scott Anderson is a former attorney for the State Department. He has a lot of experience working on cases related to victims of terrorism, and he's been following the lawsuits against the Taliban closely.
What they're arguing is directly contrary to the United States recognition policy. U.S. policy says, hey, we don't recognize the Taliban as having any claim to these assets whatsoever. And the plaintiffs are saying, yeah, but because they're in control on the ground, the Taliban controls these assets just as much as it's their own, and that's what allows us to attach them.
No Afghans were directly involved in the 9/11 attacks. And not all the families of 9/11 victims support how the plaintiffs are going after the Afghan central bank assets. One group called Peaceful Tomorrows is made up of roughly 275 family members. They appealed to President Biden in a petition, stating, quote, "We all lost loved ones on September 11th and call upon you to release the Afghan central bank funds to the Afghan people. This is their money, not ours." Regardless, the lawsuits were moving forward, and the Biden administration had a choice. Get involved. Go against the 9/11 plaintiffs and stomach the bad political optics ahead of the midterms. Or allow the lawsuits to proceed and watch the economic freefall of one of the world's poorest countries. This February, the Biden administration chose both.
On Friday, President Biden signed an executive order to split the money.
$3.5 billion will go to humanitarian projects and other basic Afghan needs.
Another $3.5 billion will compensate victims of the 9/11 attacks.
It's a little Solomonic. It's a little bit splitting the baby there. But I think it was kind of a Biden administration saying, let's just try and find an equitable way to save at least some of these money, make it available for Afghans sooner rather than later, while this litigation continues for the remaining assets.
The executive order was back in February, but the assets still haven't been released, not to the Afghan people or to the plaintiffs.
The plaintiffs are no more or no less likely to get access to this money than they were before the executive order. They are simply now only arguing over $3.5 billion, not $7 billion.
I'm just trying to gauge, like, how often does something like this happen?
As far as I am aware, the executive order on Afghanistan is pretty much unprecedented. I'm not aware of another case where we have seen a long-designated terrorist group that has been the subject of litigation, extended litigation in the United States over the last 20 years, suddenly become the, you know, de facto controller of facts on the ground in Afghanistan, if not its recognized government.
I was very disheartened when I heard the news.
Again, that's Dr. Marabi.
I remember that it says the $3.5 billion for, and the exact quote was, for the benefit of the Afghan people. This is half, you know, half of amount of money. I wanted this whole $7 billion to be released. This money is not the money that belongs to Taliban. It is money that belongs to the Afghan central bank.
The remaining $3.5 billion are still held up in negotiations. One of the sticking points is over who would control the Afghan central bank assets if they are unfrozen. The Taliban has appointed someone the U.S. doesn't trust to help oversee the Afghan central bank, a senior Taliban military leader who, since 2011, has been listed as a specially designated global terrorist. He's on the U.S. sanctions list, like a lot of other Taliban members.
United States have sanctions on Afghanistan. What it did, it choked off access to financing. It criminalized all the transactions that involved Taliban.
U.S. sanctions on the group go back to the late 90s. And after 2001, the sanctions were targeted against specific members of the group. But now that they're running the country, the sanctions are impacting every person living in Afghanistan.
Frozen funds and sanctions equal to misery, hardship, cruelty, and punishment.
Meanwhile, in Kabul, Afghans are feeling U.S. policy decisions in their markets and in their wallets.
Hello, my name is Zikria. Currently, I'm in Mandai in Kabul City.
Zikria is an aid worker with one of the few humanitarian groups still operating in Afghanistan. And for his safety, we'll only be using his first name. He sent me recordings of himself moving around Kabul. This one is from the Mandai market, a few days before the Eid al-Adha holiday.
The Mandai in Kabul city is one of the most popular and crowded bazaars in all Afghanistan.
Eid al-Adha marks the final days of the religious pilgrimage to Hajj for Muslims around the world. And it usually means big business for local vendors.
Usually, the Mandai Bazaar is very, very crowded during Eid days. But this year, it looks very different. There are less people
Zakaria talks to a few shopkeepers who say they haven't sold much, if anything.
They told me it's because so many people have lost their jobs, their work, and their income.
Zakaria leaves the market and passes by a number of banks.
New Kabul Bank, Afghan United Bank, and Afghanistan International Bank. We saw hundreds of people standing there to cash out their money. We searched a lot for ATM machines, but couldn't find any being operated. They were all closed.
Some employers have found a way around the collapsed banking sector. The company that Zakaria works for pays some of its employees in cryptocurrency. On his way home, Zakaria strikes up a conversation with a taxi driver waiting for passengers. He gets to asking about the man's holiday plans. The taxi driver tells Zakaria he's avoiding guests during Eid.
I asked why.
The taxi driver tells him it's because he and his family have nothing to offer their guests. The World Bank reports that inflation for basic household goods is 50% in Afghanistan. And the UN predicted that by this year, more than 95% of the country will be living on less than $2 a day. This is why Dr. Marabi says it's so important to unfreeze the Afghan central bank assets. He believes that engagement with the Taliban is the only path forward.
You have to separate recognition from engagement. If you don't want to recognize, that does not mean that you're going to go ahead and abandon this country. It is in the self-interest of the United States to be actively engaged in Taliban.
But this kind of philosophical question, and I don't mean to be crass, but if there is this sense of acknowledgement or normalization of this group, of the Taliban, does it not kind of also project this idea that you as a group can potentially suicide bomb your way into power?
Well, it's a political question that I don't particularly want to go ahead and be in a position to address that. So I think if you would accept my I've always said that I, when it comes to political issues, I would not make comments and then stick to what I know best. And that is economics.
But economics and politics, they go hand in hand. And earlier this month, the politics behind unfreezing the money hit another obstacle.
A CIA drone strike killed Ayman al-Zawahiri over the weekend.
When a U.S. drone strike killed the leader of al-Qaeda at a safe house in Kabul.
The Taliban claimed they had no idea that the leader of al-Qaeda was hiding out right there in Kabul, living in the same fancy upscale neighborhood where senior Taliban officials live. The Taliban condemned the operation and accused the United States of violating its peace deal with them.
The U.S. State Department and the Taliban have met at least twice this summer about the frozen assets. But the Biden administration has since described al-Zawahiri's presence in Kabul as a game changer. A spokesperson for the State Department, who responded to us over email, said that engagement with the Taliban continues to be necessary. Quote, "We cannot achieve our objectives with a policy of pure isolation. None of these engagements should be seen as legitimizing the Taliban or its so-called interim government, but are a mere reflection of the reality that we need to have such discussions in order to advance U.S. interests."
That was Reveal's Najib Amini. Since the U.S. drone attack that killed Ayman al-Zawahiri, there has been no movement on unfreezing the Afghan central bank assets. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken said in a statement that the Taliban violated its agreement with the U.S. by allowing the leader of Al-Qaeda to stay in Kabul. He added that they, quote, betrayed the Afghan people and their own stated desire for recognition. When we come back, we hear from someone who says that for Afghans living in the country, recognition is all just a matter of perspective.
I hate to quote Kanye West here, but what's a king to a god? What's a god to a non-believer?
That's next on Reveal. From the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX, this is Reveal. I'm Ike Sriskandaraja, filling in for Al Letson. All this hour, we've been raising a question key to the future of Afghanistan. Do you recognize the Taliban? And we're ending the hour today with someone who says yes, but with some caveats.
I think any short answer to this question is unfair to the question. It's a loaded question, but do I recognize them as a government? Not yet. Do I recognize them as legitimate actors within the Afghanistan political sphere? Yes. And that's where the need for reconciliation comes.
Obaidullah Bahir is a lecturer at the American University of Afghanistan, where he teaches peace and conflict resolution.
I study, eat, breathe peace and conflict resolution, and that's what I'm hoping to achieve here.
Inside and out of the classroom, he's working towards bringing Taliban and non-Taliban voices together to chart a future for the country. Part of Obaidullah's commitment to reconciliation is practical.
Due to lack of alternatives and due to the large cost of replacing or removing the Taliban now, they're just another less than ideal entity ruling a country. I think it's hypocritical to impose some of the worst possible sanctions in modern history on Afghanistan when the Taliban came to power. When the world chooses to engage with Mohammed bin Salman in Saudi Arabia, when it chooses to engage with North Korea, with China, with Russia, with Iran, unlike the international community who could opt out of the Taliban rule, the common Afghan person cannot, right? So if you can't escape or get out of Afghanistan, you are forced to live under this regime.
The other part of his commitment to reconciliation is personal. Obaidullah comes from a family with a long history at the top of Afghan politics. His grandfather, Gulbuddin Hikmatyar, served as prime minister and led a campaign during a civil war in the 90s that killed tens of thousands of civilians. Human rights groups accuse him of committing war crimes.
So I just wish that past hadn't happened, and I just hope that we never repeat that. I'm not a member of my grandfather's party, and neither do I carry his legacy. I do my own bit, and I'll keep doing it. And that also includes trying to make up for whatever baggage that I carry. And I try, and I do that day in, day out.
Part of coming to terms with that family baggage is using it. His family clout lets him criticize the Taliban in a place where people can disappear for doing just that. And he can still talk directly with them. After Kabul fell, he and a few other academics and journalists started hosting a series of conversations in something like an online town hall on Twitter.
We started taking up themes for every week. So every week we would talk about things like girls' education, women's right to work, the importance of constitution, moral policing, and what it means in the modern world.
He says thousands showed up. It was a chance for regular Afghans to ask the people in charge about the thorniest issues facing the country.
We even had a space in which we were having a heated discussion about due process and what policing should look like. And at that time, news broke that the Taliban had barged into women activists' homes and taken them away. And it was in that space that we appealed to Taliban officials who were there to step up and find out what had happened to this woman and get her released as soon as possible. Look, it might not have made a difference, but the fact that we were raising those concerns and not raising those concerns as opponents of the Taliban, but as genuine Afghan citizens who demanded things of the Taliban now that they were in power, I think that makes a difference. And that's how Afghanistan is going to move forward.
When you're organizing these spaces, who's more open and who's less open to reconciliation? Is it the average Taliban member or an average Afghan citizen? Who do you have to spend more time convincing to come have these conversations?
I mean, there are Taliban members who still believe that anything that does not follow their ideology by the pen is un-Islamic, is unacceptable. And then there are people in the diaspora that believe that the Taliban are an absolute evil that should not be reconciled with, that reconciling with is a morally questionable stance. And I think that's where a lot of energy is consumed. But yeah, look, you lock up two people who hate each other in one room long enough, they will find something in common, they will work it out.
Really? I thought there would only be one person left at the end.
Yeah, just don't leave any sharp objects in the room. But no, I mean, like, look, when there is no other option but to learn to live together. And that's why whenever I'm asked about what would happen next, I very often say that the ball is in the Taliban's court, because the Taliban have to make a decision. Do we implement an absolute version of what we believe Islamic society to be like and alienate a large chunk of the population? Do we keep using coercion as our favorite governance tool and risk that this does not stay long? I feel like the Taliban sometimes are still stuck with their social contract to their followers only, and it has to expand. They have to realize that now they're ruling a country and their social contract isn't to the few hundred thousand followers they have, but 35 million Afghans.
Obaidullah, do they have to expand though? And I don't mean to be too cynical, but they took over the country so fast and they're in charge. So I guess the question is, like, what do they have to gain by coming to the table and making concessions and compromising?
I hate to quote Kanye West here, but what's a king to a god? What's a god to a non-believer? I think if you pick up Afghanistan's history, you would realize that there have been much, much bigger and stronger forces that have attempted to rule Afghanistan with iron fists. And they have failed. I mean, if the Afghan people are famous for one thing, is that when they have enough grievances, they do something about it. And the Taliban will very soon be faced with that situation unless they choose to accommodate Afghans and what they want, right? So that's why it's up to them. They don't have to. Yes, maybe they can choose to go down the road that they're going and choose to not accommodate anyone, but that would be a very short-lived regime. Or they can use this opportunity of the active conflict ending after 40 continuous years of war and build something sustainable. But that would have to include others beyond them.
We started our conversation by asking you if you accept the Taliban, and it sounds like that has to go both ways. And from what you're seeing on the ground and what you're saying, that acceptance is starting to happen and is mutual.
Yeah. I mean, the Taliban that I sat across probably 2 months ago, they wouldn't have wanted to sit across me. I wouldn't have wanted to sit across them, but we did, right? And the Taliban fighters and the way that we interact now at checkpoints and how we interacted 1 year ago, those are very different. So things are changing, and I'm hoping that it keeps happening for the better.
Finally, we asked Obaidullah if our question, "Do you recognize the Taliban?" was even the right one to be asking.
We don't need to deal in absolutes. It doesn't need to be a binary between recognition and non-recognition, because this is the reality of all of Afghanistan. So I guess recognition is something that has to be contingent on internal legitimacy. Internal legitimacy has to be contingent on them creating a setup that is representative of Afghanistan. Once that internal legitimacy happens, international recognition can follow. But meanwhile, while all of this happens, engagement is fundamental and vital.
That was Obaidullah Bahir, a lecturer at the American University of Afghanistan. Our lead producer and reporter for this week's show is Najib Amini. Jenny Casas edited the show with help from Mariam Saleh. Dhruv Mehrotra and Sue Oh provided the data analysis for today's show, and Sean Musgrave helped FOIA for the data. Special thanks to Cynthia Rodriguez, Aura Bogado, and Kevin Sullivan. Nikki Frick is our fact checker. Victoria Baranetsky is our general counsel. Our production manager is Amy Mustafa. Score and sound design by Jim Briggs and Fernando Arruda. By the way, welcome, Baby Magnolia. Our post-production team this week also includes Claire Mullen, Catherine Steyer Martinez, and Stephen Rascone. Our digital producer is Sarah Merck. Our CEO is Kezar Kampwala. Sumi Agarwal is our editor-in-chief. Our interim executive producers are Brett Myers and Taki Talanidis. Our theme music is by Camarado Lightning. Support for Reveal is provided by the Reva and David Logan Foundation, the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, the Jonathan Logan Family Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the Heising Simons Foundation, the Hellman Foundation, the Democracy Fund, and the In As Much Foundation. I'm Ike Sriskandaraja. Next week...
They had pig masks on.
Yeah, we brainwash them because their brain is dirty.
Drug therapy, that is work with no pay.
To me, it was like free labor, like slave labor.
We revisit our investigative series that exposed the cultish origin of a form of drug treatment that is now ubiquitous. Returning to American Rehab on the next Reveal.